From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, terror and counter-terror. A court blocks the president on immigration. Jeb Bush talks foreign policy and a ceasefire mocked in Ukraine. At a White House conference on violent extremism, the president worked hard to deny the weight of Islam to ISIS.
Nor should we grant these terrorists the religious legitimacy that they seek. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists.
A federal judge blocks President Obama's immigration orders. Texas Governor Greg Abbott brought the suit, saying the president overreached.
In Texas, we will not sit idly by while the president ignores the law and fails to secure the border.
And Russian-backed separatists blast away in Ukraine, taking turf, ignoring a brand new ceasefire. Clarissa Ward of CBS News.
The ceasefire may have been in place for 3 days, but the guns have not stayed silent.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Maria Elena Salinas of Univision, Margaret Brennan of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining me now from Miami is Maria Elena Salinas, co-anchor of Noticiero Univision, the nightly evening newscast on the big American Spanish language television network, and co-anchor of Aquí y Ahora, news magazine program there. Maria Elena Salinas, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure.
And from Washington, Margaret Brennan joins us, CBS News correspondent covering the State Department and all things global. Margaret Brennan, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Maria Elena. Hello, Margaret.
There is so much news this week. On Sunday, kind of kicked off with a terrible video released by ISIS showing the beheading of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians on the beach in Libya. A masked ISIS member wields that dagger, threatens the West.
And we will conquer Rome by Allah's permission, the promise of our Prophet, peace be upon him.
By Wednesday at the White House, the summit on countering violent extremism, President Obama didn't want to give any religious standing to ISIS. He said, it's a lie.
We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie.
Margaret Brennan, let's go straight to this, the sort of matchup of that video, that terrible video from the beach in Libya, and the summit in Washington. Do these connect? Do they meet?
They certainly do meet, but in terms of cause and effect, you can't link them. This summit here in Washington that's still ongoing today is really kind of an academic exercise with world leaders, U.S. officials, all sort of spinning ideas of how to defeat the idea of extremism, not just on the battlefield, but online. And it's really hard to extinguish an ideology and an idea, and that's really at the heart of what ISIS is. It's easier to talk in terms of what's happening on the battlefield, and we do see that confrontation in Iraq and Syria. Libya and these terrorists who carried out this beheading, the administration's being really careful about the language it uses in this sense. They're not even calling it an attack carried out by ISIS. They're calling it ISIS-affiliated groups. And what you're seeing is this creeping extremism and more groups glomming on to what seems to be the dominant form of it right now, and ISIS. It's the most vocal, and it's certainly dominating in the online space.
Margaret, why is the president working so hard, bending over backwards? It's just clear to try and keep Islam out of the labels here, out of the language here.
Right. Well, it's a really difficult question to answer because you can see all points. One of them is that the president's not just speaking to an American populace. He's speaking to a global audience. Many of the members of the coalition, arguably some of the most important ones that the U.S. needs standing beside them in this coalition against ISIS, are Arab Muslim countries. You don't want to alienate, and you don't want to make this a clash of civilizations type thing, because some would argue that's exactly the kind of apocalyptic worldview ISIS wants to glom onto. But at the same time, you could say this is a war on Salafism. That's the branch of Islam that ISIS has sort of grown out of, I should say, and taken an extremely violent form of it. It's hard to say whose religion is a more pure version than somebody else's, but certainly what they're practicing is not in line with what the more than 1.6 billion Muslims around the world carry out every day.
Maria Elena, Jack, lots of leaders wrestling with this in the past couple of weeks. Here was the Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt talking on Monday at a press conference after the terrorist attacks in Copenhagen over the weekend left two dead there. She, like President Obama, saying this is about terrorism, not religion.
This is not a conflict between Islam and the West. This is not a conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims. This is a conflict between the core values of our society and violent extremists.
It's about core values and extremists. The president saying just yesterday the West must not be drawn into the construct of a war with Islam.
The notion that the West is at war with Islam is an ugly lie. And all of us, regardless of our faith, have a responsibility to reject it.
But the president caught a lot of flack for that in the United States. On Wednesday, Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas attacked him for not using the phrase Islamic extremism, said it was hurting the effort to fight ISIS or the Islamic State.
What undermines the global effort is for the president of the United States to be an apologist for radical Islamic terrorists. The president and this administration dogmatically refuses to utter the words radical Islamic terrorism. You cannot defeat an enemy if you refuse to acknowledge what it is.
Ted Cruz takes it a further bridge there, calling the president an apologist. I did not hear that. But Maria Elena, what do you think? Is this translating to the American public, the president saying, let's not go down this religious war language path? Or do people just want it laid out, you know, clean and clear, even if that's dangerous strategically?
I think what Ted Cruz is saying actually resonates with hardcore right-wing Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans. He's saying what they want to hear. But, you know, the president, it's important for him to make it clear that the war against terrorism is not a war against Islam. I think it's very important, particularly because we have such large Islamic communities here or Muslim communities here in the U.S. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons. One is to dissuade young Muslims in this country who might be contemplating joining forces with Islam. And it's also important to have some Muslim countries support the fight against terror. He wants it to be their war also. And I think after the horrible burning of the Jordanian pilot, I think it's evident that this is a war. It's a war against everyone. It's all a war against everyone. It's not just that. He wants to send that message. This is not a war between ISIS and the U.S. It's a war between ISIS and everyone else.
Jack,
every civilized country.
Yeah, Jack, the ISIS people, Islamic State people, are determined to make that very, very difficult. I mean, this very professional video that came out of the horrible mass beheading on the beach there, and you've got the guy, you know, standing right there talking about Allah, talking about taking Rome, that is the seat of historically of Christendom. ISIS seems to want this framing, Jack.
To want it and to provoke the West with it, to provoke more intervention. That clearly is their dialectic. That was the case with Al-Qaeda right from the beginning. Osama bin Laden said, we want the West to intervene, and that will make more recruits for us. And now you have Egypt calling for a sort of multinational intervention in Libya. So, yes, they define themselves in these terms, in these civilizational terms. More than that, you know, they're really a piece in the Atlantic by Graham Wood this week that got a lot of attention. He says that pretending that it's not, that ISIS isn't a religious millenarian group, has already led the U.S. to underestimate it and back foolish schemes to counter it. That's to say that this isn't just an academic matter, that if the government thinks, if our administration thinks, there, you know, downplays the infection of apocalyptic ideology, Islamic ideology, is it limiting its effectiveness in the war, certainly in the propaganda war against it? That does seem something feeble in the president's comments and in the comments of John Kerry and others, that poverty is the issue here and so on. Well, you know, Muhammad Atta was an engineer. He was not a poor man. The people on that, who attacked us on 9/11 in the main were not, you know, lumpen proletariat. They had educations, many of them. So it just seems like that we're going out of our way not to name the enemy for good reason. We heard it from Margaret about the international situation and you know, the domestic situation. But on the other hand, are we limiting our effectiveness by not seeing what's involved here in the mobilization of disaffected and perhaps poor young men by this ideology.
It's a slippery slope, though. You can get on in a hurry, turn on Fox News, there's Bill O'Reilly with a big sign that says, "Holy War." And suddenly it's framed just that way. Margaret Brennan, as the country has debated all this, word from the Pentagon that they're going to go after the Islamic State in Mosul. They're going to take it back as early as next month or April with 25,000 troops. Whose troops? Is this realistic, Margaret? We didn't have the sense that we were on the verge of flipping all this the other way. What do you make of this announcement?
Well, there was an expectation there would be a spring offensive against ISIS. But what is so unusual for this announcement to come from CENTCOM, from the, you know, head of U.S. forces, is that you're signaling to the enemy what a foreign allied military is about to do. It's a bit of maybe a psychological warfare, but it's really also a bit of PR, because this is about showing that the Iraqi military, which had dissolved in the facing the threat of ISIS, is now being trained by U.S. special ops, and it's being assisted in the air by U.S. warplanes.
But now they've got to do it. They've got to take it if they want to have credibility. Do they have the capacity to do that? No one has. I mean, the Saudis this week saying you got a bunch of pinprick airstrikes. Nothing's going right here.
Right. And you've got a lot of complaints from within the Iraqi government, including from the prime minister, saying, I need more help. I need more heavy weaponry. I need you to deliver on all of the military hardware you promised me. I mean, the F-16s that Iraq bought aren't in Baghdad. They're sitting in Arizona because they cannot be shipped to Iraq right now, because U.S. contractors, it's not safe enough for them to be there to service the planes. So, yes, exactly right. This is a bit of PR. And I would also point out, perception maybe be reality in the political space, but what the U.S. is not doing in Syria is probably even more powerful when it comes to feeding into the ideology of ISIS. Well, they see.
Hold that thought, Margaret. We've got to take a break right here. Maybe PR, but April is going to be here very fast. The proof in the pudding there. Margaret Brennan with CBS, please stand by. Maria Elena Salinas with Univision, wonderful to have you. Jack, we'll come right to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. ISIS savagery, a Washington summit on terror, an immigration standoff, icy cold in the eastern U.S. Jack in West Palm Beach, Florida. Thank you for calling, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Tom, my question is this. I'm wondering why the true believers in Islam, the true followers of Muhammad, why aren't they organizing an expeditionary force of their own to go over and fight ISIS? You know, why aren't they recruiting people in North America, Europe, Southeast Asia to get men to sign up and go over and take up arms and help defeat this bastardization of Islam?
Jack, that is it's a good question. It's a cheeky question. But what about the fact, Jack, that you've got Jordanians and Iraqis and UAE and Saudis? I mean, they are contributing to this effort that the U.S. is involved in right now to hit ISIS. That is not enough for you?
It's not enough, because we have young men from these countries I mentioned who are being recruited to go over and fight for ISIS. So,
right.
So
where are the real Muslims if this is a bastardization? Jack, let me hold that right there and get one more call. I will come to it. Hassan in Seattle, Washington. Hassan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, hi, guest. I just wanted to say that there's a glaring gap in the conversation that takes place here in America and what actually goes the conversation that takes place within Muslim communities. You know, the last guy just mentioned, why aren't Muslims, you know, going over that overseas and fighting. I mean, for the last 50, 60 years, the United States tied itself to Saudi Arabia, and they allowed the Saudis to spread their Wahhabi ideology, which is basically the root cause of this type of belief. Granted, you know, they don't obviously encourage ISIS-type behavior, but it is the seed. The Wahhabi ideology is so extreme, is so intolerant that this has been happening. So Muslims have been fighting this. You know, thousands of Muslims have been slaughtered over the last 50, 60 years at the hands of Wahhabi Salafi groups. And now ISIS, all it is just the Frankenstein of that Saudi-created monster.
So, Hassan, let me ask you, to Jack's point in a way, and the bigger question, is the president right, Jack? I mean, Hassan, to avoid the word Islamic extremism, or is he missing some element of the point here?
I think there is a little bit of an element of point that's being missing, because, you know, there is, obviously this is a fringe movement within Islam. It's always been there. But, you know, throughout the centuries, a lot of sultans and a lot of different kings and whoever were able to put them down. It's ever since the 1930s and 40s when, you know, United States, United Kingdom, you know, basically tied their fate to the Saudis, who had tied their fate to Wahhabi ideology, that this has grown. Again, it's still not even 5% of Islam, but it's still effective enough to cause this much of a mess. And, I mean, we see it. And the Saudis, I mean, I always found it comical that the United States, you know, just came out again saying they're going to team up with the Saudis and Turks to train Syrian rebels to counter this. When does that work? This is the same headline that we've seen over the last 3 years. It's not going
to
work.
So what will work, Hassan, to Jack's question out of Florida, will Muslims themselves rise up and stop the Islamic State or flock to join it?
I mean, isn't that happening? Look, like, okay, I understand the United States is, you know, carrying out airstrikes, but who is the one that's doing fighting? You have, you know, common Muslim farmers, mechanics, and teachers fighting against these guys. So this is this notion that somehow Muslims aren't speaking out or aren't fighting with them is just ridiculous. I mean, this type of, you know, let's create these Western trained Muslims and send them overseas. Isn't that what we did with? Isn't that what we did in the 80s? And we got the Taliban because we teamed up with the Saudis.
Yeah,
I mean, this, you're asking to repeat something that's already failed and that's led to the situation that we're in today.
Hassan, I'm very glad for your call. Let me get one more and I'll come to my panel. Richard, thank you, Hassan. And Jack, Richard in Marion, South Carolina. Richard, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate you allowing us, the little guys out here, to have a soapbox so that folks can see how people out here really think.
Let's hear it.
I think that Barack Obama, in not injecting the word Islamic into what's going on now in the Middle East, is far more knowledgeable about geopolitics than the likes of Ted Cruz and Rudy Giuliani, and it's way too obvious. I wish somebody would muzzle Ted Cruz and Rudy Giuliani when they get on our president, particularly when Barack Obama's in the middle of such a mess all over the world geopolitically. The reason Barack Obama is not using the word Islamic makes more sense to me than anybody else could ever imagine, because that's exactly what ISIS wants him to do.
So you're with the president. Let's not stampede the Muslims in the main into this corner by drawing a bright line here. I appreciate your call as well, Richard. Maria Elena Salinas, what about Richard raises Rudy Giuliani with some very out there remarks this week. He was at this fundraiser on Wednesday night for Scott Walker of Wisconsin, who, of course, is eyeing the White House.
Obama does not love America. Yeah,
let me read this, Marie Lincoln. You got the heart of it. But he says, I do not believe, and I know this is a horrible thing to say, but I do not believe that the president loves America, he said. He doesn't love you, and he doesn't love me. He wasn't brought up the way you were brought up, and I was brought up through love of this country. What's that about, Maria Elena?
There's no basis for him to say that. This is politics. Remember that we are already beginning the campaign for 2016, and more importantly, getting ready for the primaries. And even though Rudy Giuliani is not running for anything that we know of right now, you know, he's preparing the GOP to get that kind of support, and it has to be not so much a pro-GOP campaign, but an anti-Obama campaign.
But Obama's not running again.
Not running again, but he's, you know, that's the thing. That's the issue, I think, that the Republicans are right now. Well, now we're getting into U.S. politics, but yeah, the problem with the Republicans right now is that they're attacking Obama. Obama's not running for anything, and he made it very clear during his State of the Union that, you know, he's not running for anything, that he already ran for office and won twice, you know, which got a few laps here and there. But, you know, this kind of talk, this kind of rhetoric really does attract, whether it comes from Ted Cruz, whether it comes from Giuliani, it just rallies the base of Republicans. But does it really solve the problem? You know, again, I think we have to remember that ISIS is an equal opportunity savage. And the only way to beat ISIS is with the help of Muslim countries. That's very clear.
They burned 40 plus. Yeah, burned 40 plus Iraqis alive this week in Iraq.
Exactly. So, you know, what he wants to show that Islamic nations are not with them, that they do not speak for them, that takes power away from them. These people are killing anyone, even their own people. If they're capable of killing their own people, then who do they represent? What do they represent, if not just terrorism?
Jack Beatty, bring it home. When Rudy Giuliani says, I do not believe that the president loves America, is that just Rudy being Rudy, whatever that means? Is that important to some rallying cry now? Isn't he kind of beating a dead horse? Wasn't that 8 years ago?
He certainly tried it 8 years ago. Well, I think he gave the right judgment on his own statement. Quote, it's a horrible thing to say. And he said it. It's a racist dog whistle. There's just no question about it. You know, James Kloppenberg, the Harvard historian, writing in New York Magazine recently, said that President Obama has had the worst comment from the opposition against him than any American president since Lincoln. And Lincoln faced an armed rebellion. Now, is it just a coincidence that Mr. Obama is also our first black president? You know, you can't prove these things, and even to raise them feels somehow unfair. And yet, this kind of thing wasn't said, or couldn't have been said, I don't think, about other presidents. Bad things were said about Bill Clinton. Bad things were said about George Bush. But nothing quite like this. Nothing that goes to this idea of you are not a real American, Mr. President. My God, if he's not, Barack Obama's not, an American success story, then self-made man is a total myth. I mean, that's what he is. But
let's bring it back to presidential authority on another front here. This week we had the federal judge in Brownsville, Texas, putting a block on the president's executive order on immigration that would have, put a stay on deportation for 5 million or more immigrants in this country. It was celebrated on the right. It was not celebrated at the White House. That's a big deal. Here was former Texas Governor Rick Perry weighing in with Fox News' Megyn Kelly. More than two dozen states, he said, saw the executive order of the president as executive overreach.
It's a victory for the rule of law, and that's what this is really about. So you got 26 states that are standing up and saying that this country is based on the rule of law. You can't have presidents just willy-nilly going around and using their executive fiat whenever they feel it's in their best interest or what they want to see.
It was a hard hip check on the president's move to exert executive authority here. He spoke in the Oval Office to reporters on Tuesday, saying the law's on his side.
And I'm confident that it is well within my authority, and the tradition of the executive branch's prosecutorial discretion. To execute this policy, which will help us make our borders safer, will help us go after criminals and those that we don't want in this country, will help people get on the right side of the law and get out of the shadows.
Millions have been waiting on this executive order to take effect. Here was from Houston's NBC affiliate KXAN on Monday. They talked with dreamer Manuel Ramirez, brought to the U.S. as a child, disappointed to wake up to this news.
Not the best news you could hear in the morning. I mean, my family, my friends, my colleagues, we were really excited that this was happening. A lot of folks have been, waiting for decades.
Maria Elena Salinas, what about this? The president says he thinks the law is on his side, but the federal courts have the upper hand right now. His order is blocked. Does he figure out a way around this? What happens legally here?
The administration waited years to finally take action, so I highly doubt that the president would present those executive actions without making sure that he had the authority to do it. They've been weighing on this for many, many, many years and waiting basically for a Republican leadership to pass some kind of immigration reform. They have said that they would not do that. They would not support or even introduce legislation on immigration reform that would open the door to the legalization of undocumented immigrants. I'm not a lawyer, but, what's very clear here is that what the judge did was just halt the implementation of the executive actions. The governor of Texas said that this rules his orders unconstitutional, but it does not. It does not, because the only thing that it's doing up to now is saying, wait, we have to wait until these 26 states, the lawsuit from these 26 states goes through the court system to decide whether it's legal or not. I mean, it is a setback for the White House. It's even worse for immigrants who have been waiting. There's political consequences to this, but the worst part is the human toll that it's going to have affecting people like the young man who just mentioned. There's almost 5 million immigrants that could have benefited from this. And these are not criminals. These are immigrants. First of all, they're not getting amnesty. All they're getting is an opportunity not to be deported, to stay here and work temporarily. And you're talking about children who were brought here when they were very young at, no fault of their own, and also including now parents of children born in the United States. There are over, there's millions of children that were born here who have been separated from their parents, and tragic stories. And there are rules that you have to follow in order to be able to qualify for DACA and for DAPA. So this was not an amnesty. You're not talking about criminals. And if the president did not have the right to do it, then if the law was not on his side, I don't think he would have taken that chance.
Jack, the courts can always come in, and when they do, the Constitution is always in the conversation. The president says he's confident he has the executive authority, but this judge, conservative and no fan, he's on the record as being no fan of Obama immigration policy. But how do you look at it, Jack? Does the president have precedent and the Constitution on his side here, or does this judge, is he on to something, that this is more than presidents have historically done?
Well, he's on to something, but not there. He stayed away from the constitutional issue. He went instead to a procedural issue that the administration implemented this change in violation of what's called the Administrative Procedure Act.
Didn't take comment enough.
Yes, exactly. It didn't take enough comment. And if it had followed that procedure, well, perhaps the judge wouldn't have objected. Well, we don't really know. Some people say if the administration now did take public comment, that could drag on for months, for a year. Sometimes these things drag on. We've seen that with other issues.
If the White House appeals, I'm reading here, it goes to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the nation's most conservative appeals court. If they rule against it, goes to the Supreme Court. We could get into the Constitution in a hurry here.
We could indeed. People cite, and I suppose there are people who are friendly to the administration, that three recent Supreme Court decisions which seem to say that the federal government has the call on all matters relating to immigration, or most matters, and certainly on the issue of prioritization. But, you know, there's another side of this, and that's what this means for the Republicans. Speaker Boehner, over the weekend, basically said, we'll have a shutdown if we have to have a shutdown of the 30,000 people on the Homeland Security Department,
which is all tied into this through the budget. That's where they were looking for their leverage on immigration.
That's right. And within 5 days, that could happen. And he seemed to be, if we have to do it, we have to do it. This gives the Republicans this decision at least a temporary off-ramp from what would have been a politically damaging step. They can, you know, say, well, we're going to punt for a month. We'll fund the whole Homeland Security for a month and see how things go with this appeal. So it may have all if it complicated matters for the president, it may have relieved a looming crisis for the Republicans.
Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. You know, I look at this, those 28 Republican attorney generals, at really confirming what we think of the Republican Party out here. They're showing their racist colors once again. And here's the thing. There are 50,000 Hispanics are turning 18 each month. And who are the Republican Party thinks that those guys are going to vote for, knowing that they've been this way, that they've been treated as a quote-unquote other? And this just ties right into what Rudy Giuliani said about the president, the way Hispanics have been treated over the past 8, 9, 10 years.
Carl, you know Republican respondent would say it's not about racism, it's about the law. Follow the law at the border and we're fine with everything.
You know, perception is everything. And if you're perceived to be one thing and you keep doing the things that make you be perceived to be that thing, then guess what, Tom? You are that thing. And by the way, Tom, my wife told me to tell you hi.
Hi to your wife, Carl. It's been a while. Thank you for your call, Carl. We're up against a break here. It's good to hear from you. Maria Elena Salinas with Univision, please stand by in Miami. Margaret Brennan with CBS News at the State Department in Washington. Jack Beatty, this is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Audible has more than 150,000 titles to choose from, plus exclusive content. From fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable, so you're certain to find something interesting. On Point listeners can try it for free. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. And get started today.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Saturday Night Live turned 40 with a huge lineup of SNL veterans coming back to play. Dan Aykroyd brought back his fake late-night ad for the Bass-O-Matic.
Drop the bass, that's the whole bass, into Super Bass-O-Matic 2150.
A rare victory for the Best in Show category at this year's Westminster Dog Show. Miss P, the Beagle, beat out the other more coiffed competitors.
Last night, Miss P won Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. She beat out lots of canines with fancy haircuts, striking a blow, as one writer put it, for normal dogs.
And celebration in my house, where the dog is a beagle. And singer-songwriter Leslie Gore has died at 68. She was still in high school when she topped the charts in 1963.
It's my party and I'll cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you.
Wow, a whole lot of juice all these years later. We're looking at a week in the news. ISIS savagery, Washington summit on terror, immigration standoff. Cold in the east, warm in the west, superbug in the west, in California as well. I want to turn to Ukraine. It was all about ceasefire. It seems like what it was just a week ago with heads of state from Europe. Margaret, I'm going to come to you on this. Lining up with Vladimir Putin, they didn't look happy, but they looked like they had a ceasefire. Well, hardly. On Tuesday, the fighting hadn't stopped. UN Security Council unanimously approved that resolution to endorse the Minsk ceasefire deal. It was U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, welcoming the agreement, but saying, Russia, prove that you're really into it.
Stop arming the separatists. Stop sending hundreds of heavy weapons across the border in addition to your troops. Stop pretending you are not doing what you are doing. And start calling on and insisting upon the separatists observing the ceasefire around Debaltseve.
Margaret, none of that happened. Debaltseve, this transport hub in the east of Ukraine, we watched Ukrainian troops ultimately flee under punishing bombardment from Russian artillery and tanks. What has happened in Ukraine this week, Margaret, and what does it mean?
Well, it was a ceasefire in name only. Even the head of NATO has acknowledged that. U.S. officials saw, even in the days leading up to the ceasefire, that Russia was creating what they called facts on the ground. That is, grab as much territory, grab those key hubs, like you mentioned, so that you can change borders. So that when you're negotiating a ceasefire or something more substantial, you've already got that ground sort of in your control and you can demand terms. The Ukrainians are saying today that they're seeing more Russian military equipment crossover, tanks and the like, something that other Western diplomats haven't yet confirmed. But today, I mean, it's symbolic because this day a year ago is when sniper fire tore through the crowds in the center of Kiev, which was really that turning point in the uprising that brought about the fall of the Ukrainian government and really turned this into all-out war.
But it's something else for heads of state of Europe, of Germany and France, to sit with Vladimir Putin, and he essentially, it turns out, lies in their faces. I mean, here he was, the Russian president. This was on Tuesday in Hungary, of all places, a joint press conference there. He laid a wreath at a memorial for fallen Soviet soldiers at a cemetery that includes a monument for soldiers who died in 1956, crushing an anti-Soviet uprising in Hungary. Putin's putting a wreath there, and then he talks about Ukraine and says, oh, you know, losing is tough.
Of course, it is always painful to lose, especially when you're losing not to regular military, but to people who just yesterday used to be miners or truck drivers. But life goes on, and I believe you shouldn't really clutch to your old grievances of the past.
Losing hurts. Get over it. Eileen in Southbury, Connecticut. Eileen, you're on the air.
Yes, I definitely know that we should be fighting for Ukraine, one, because we owe it to them under the Budapest 1994 memorandum that only Clinton signed not even 20 years ago, and where Ukraine had on its land the world's third largest nuclear arsenal that was left by Russia, that was strategically placed to attack the United States of America. And they're just going to put those just more sophisticated arsenal back on Ukrainian soil. One, for that reason, if not to uphold your word and look and be what we should be, which is keeping our word.
But what do you mean, really mean, Eileen, when you say we should be fighting Russia? I mean, you want to see American troops in there? You want to see tons of American arms in there? Where does that go?
Yes, I do, because we promised Ukraine that when they had the world's third largest nuclear arsenal, and we meddled in their business, and we said, you know, we assure you that if you are attacked, we will back you. They gave them security assurance. They would have never done it. Ukraine has been attacked time after time after time, and Ukraine felt the comfort of America, England, China, even Russia signed this Budapest memorandum.
Yeah, kind of a cold comfort this week as all those boots on the ground from the Russian side and equipment and all the rest just continue to roll and pound. On Wednesday, we had the Ukrainian President Poroshenko calling for the UN to get in there, international help, peacekeepers.
Today I want to raise the question of inviting to Ukraine a peace mission of the United Nations, which will work according to the mandate of the UN Security Council.
Margaret Brennan, is the UN responding on this front? Could that ever happen? I mean, after all, Russia's on the Security Council. Couldn't they veto anything like that?
You're exactly right, which is why this is really going to be more about pressure on the sanctions front. You would have to get Russia to agree to allow to go along with this to a certain extent. And it's important to remember that the debate is still ongoing within the U.S. administration. Policymakers are currently reviewing the president's decisions here and saying maybe we should look at giving defensive equipment to the Ukrainian military so that they can at least be a little bit more on par with the type of heavy weapons that the Russians are giving to separatists, or that the U.S. says they're giving to separatists. But the president has been really reluctant to do that because he doesn't want to justify President Putin's what they believe is President Putin's aim, which is to have a direct conflict here, a sort of Cold War showdown. And they believe that by providing direct weapons, that you might actually reframe the conflict as that.
You mean he wants not only a chunk of Ukraine, but he actually wants an active or a Cold War conflict with the West?
No one would say they could necessarily get inside his head and predict it out that far. But certainly the language and the mentality and the nationalistic, ideology that's being invoked here recalls that kind of Cold War mindset where it's actually helpful domestically, politically for him, particularly when the economy is suffering.
In part because of sanctions. You get in a cycle right there. Casey in Atlanta, Georgia. Casey, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are y'all doing?
Okay, what do you see?
So Putin, I think I saw in the news the other day that some of his aircraft breached Britain's airspace. And it seems like he's been increasingly testing European and British airspace. I want to see if that gives any indications as to what his broader intentions might be.
Yeah, we'll pick it up. Thank you, Casey. Jack Beatty, what about it? I mean, it's one thing. You and others have articulated the view that, look, Russia's a great power. It's going to have influence in the countries right around it. Okay, but here we are. He sat down with Angela Merkel, who's kind of important to his economy. With the head of France, he makes an agreement for a ceasefire and then just coldly the separatists go ahead and totally ignore it. Are those who worry about Estonia and Latvia and other perimeter countries to Russia unrealistic now, Jack?
Well, those countries have Russian-speaking minorities, and in some of them, those countries, the Russian speakers don't have equal rights to the native speakers. And that is a point of friction that is exploitable by Moscow. So that is
exploitable. Ukraine-style means exploiting, that means come and take a chunk of the territory. Is that on the table here now?
No, that can't be.
Ukraine, that's exactly the argument that was used.
Yeah, but here's the difference. Ukraine is not in NATO. And the Baltics are, and crossing that line would involve him in a war war, and I don't think he wants to go there. Subversion, that's a much more likely path. You know, our caller raised the issue of military intervention. A Moscow woman told a reporter this week, she says, you know, this business about Ukraine, it's a war between what she called the television and the refrigerator. On the television, here are the perfidies of the Ukrainian fascists and American CIA. Morning, noon, and night, all you get is how awful everything is in Ukraine. But the refrigerator, she goes to it, and there just is less there. There's nothing from abroad there. And you know, eventually that refrigerator is going to be almost empty, and then empty, and then will there be a change? You know, it's shocking when you realize we haven't gone to the one sanction that some people think could really change things, and that is banning Russia from the SWIFT system of international banking payments. That means basically your money is no good. You can't do business with anybody anywhere. We've done that with Iran, and you know, some people say we're on a scale of 3 on the sanctions, and the SWIFT is a 10. Well, let's go up that ladder some and see if we can empty that refrigerator some more and put some pressure on Mr. Putin that way, rather than the military intervention.
We're headed up ladders here. Maria Elena, do you sense an appetite in the United States for this country to really confront Putin's Russia over Ukraine?
No, I think there's very little support for something like that. I don't think that people are focused on Ukraine right now. I don't think that the American people want to get the U.S. involved in another war directly. But, you know, it's interesting to see how Putin is part of this negotiation of this diplomatic effort. And you wonder just how real is it? I mean, when you hear him say it's hard to lose, you wonder, is he talking about losing lives, or is he talking about losing ground and losing the war, losing what
seemed to me he's saying, Ukraine, get over it. You're going to lose this. Just get over it. Yeah, I know it hurts, but get over it.
All right, well, then why are they doing this ceasefire? It's crazy because ceasefires don't work. Politicians,
paper,
and diplomats,
huh?
They talk about it and they discuss it, and the people on the ground just want to kill as many as they can before anything happens. And that's the way it is in Ukraine. That's the way it is in most countries that have this type of a conflict, where the people on the ground, they're just there to fight the enemy, and they're just there to kill as many people as they can.
Well, they've got
diplomatic
the turf
efforts
right now.
In this case are actually rushing some of these deaths.
We've got talk about foreign policy in this country from a new quarter this week. Jeb Bush speaking at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, saying, don't compare me to others. Times change. Everybody has different circumstances. So would he.
Every president inherits a changing world and changing circumstances. In the 1991 Gulf War time frame, hardly anyone knew that the Internet existed or who Al-Qaeda was. In 2003, at the beginning of the liberation of Iraq, neither Twitter nor ISIS existed. New circumstances require new approaches.
Citing the era of two other Bush presidencies there, but then going on to say, look, I'm my own man.
I love my brother. I love my dad. I actually love my mother as well. I hope that's okay. And I admire their service to the nation and the difficult decisions that they had to make. But I'm my own man, and my views are shaped by my own thinking and my own experiences.
Margaret Brennan, he talked about a liberty, but also about working with powers that be to secure security here. What was the big message out of the Jeb Bush foreign policy speech?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that isn't totally acknowledged is that this whole debate about the authorization for use of force in Iraq and Syria that Congress is having right now is that this is a war that whomever wins, whether it be Jeb Bush or somebody else, they're going to have to pick up and deal with, because this conflict with ISIS is going to be ongoing. So working with the powers that be may be working with the conflicts that are presently being looked at right now. But, you know, there's been a large criticism among many quarters, including among some very prominent Democrats on the Hill, that this administration, this president, Obama, has not kept Congress informed to the extent they would like to be about some of the diplomatic breakthroughs they've had, whether it be Cuba, whether it be Iran. There have been constant complaints, whether it be seeking more counsel on how to handle Syria and the ongoing conflict there that gave rise to ISIS. So that may be a nod in some ways to some of those issues.
George Bush pushed the democracy agenda in the Middle East. LA Times interpreting Jeb Bush as saying more stability, less democracy. Maria Elena Salinas, I want to turn to a little corner of Washington State, South Central Washington State here, that I had not heard of. You raised it to my attention. Pasco, Washington, February 10th, a Mexican national there. This is 57% Hispanic community, 20% of the population undocumented. Lots of agriculture here, apples and cherries and potatoes and on and on. Mexican national shot and killed by police. You have raised the question of whether we may have another Ferguson brewing here or whether the Hispanic population is so worried about deportation that they can't rise as Ferguson rose.
You know, what's really sad about this is that, you know, we did see a lot of action in Ferguson and also in New York with the killing of two African-Americans, but we haven't seen the uprising across the United States because of the death of Antonio Zambrano Montes, this Mexican national who was killed by police after throwing rocks at cars and at officers. And this is just one of so many deaths of Hispanic immigrants. Just Mexicans, the Mexican government has estimated that there's, in the last decade, 70 Mexicans who have been killed by U.S. authorities, yet we do not see that kind of uprising. In the case of Pasco in Washington, you're right. It is a 57% Hispanic community, and there is, in a way, a fear, number one, because a good part of that community is undocumented, that they will not be taken for granted. And that they will not, whatever their voice will not be heard. But then, you know, it begs the question, immigrants, aren't immigrants people too? You know, they said, yes, African Americans are people too. Well, immigrants are people too. And they deserve the same rights as anyone else in this country.
A little harder to get in the streets. The rumor in Pasco was that immigration was on the ground and ready to deport people keeping their heads down. But Maria Elena Salinas, alerting us to the dissatisfaction, the unhappiness around that incident, and we appreciate that. Maria Elena Salinas with Univision, thank you very much for joining us today from Miami.
My pleasure.
Margaret Brennan with CBS News and the State Department out of Washington. Margaret, thank you for being here.
Great to be with you.
And Jack Beatty, great as always to have you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.